lascivious molestation of the girls. According to the arrest affidavit, the officer is accused of reaching under the victim's clothes and touching their genitals. Hughes, who is at home since his release, has not commented on the charges. A police officer working in Middlesex, Pennsylvania, has been charged with forcing three women to have sex with him by threatening to have them charged for prostitution if they refused. An account in an Associated Press story says that Officer Kenny Johnson is currently on trial facing charges of rape, sexual assault, and obstruction of justice. One of the witnesses in the officer's trial has claimed that Johnson had sex with her over a three-year period beginning in 1998 in the officer's squad car, at a police station, and in the officer's home. The officer claims that he was dating two of his three victims. A police officer in Cocoa, Florida, found himself under arrest this week after police raided an adult club and charged nine people with sex crimes. According to WFTV, police were acting on complaints about illicit activity in the theater section of the business and arrested nine people on charges ranging from exposing themselves to committing a variety of sex acts. Sergeant Jay Padgett of the University of Central Florida Police Department was among those arrested in the raid. A police officer in Sandwich, Massachusetts, has resigned from the force this week after being charged with soliciting sex from a minor on the internet. The Associated Press reports that Officer Michael Kaiko, who was assigned to work with school children, was accused of trying to solicit a New Jersey police officer who was posing online as a 14-year-old girl. He was suspended without pay on February 3rd and resigned on February 15th prior to a disciplinary hearing. The officer's trial will begin on July 18th. A police officer in Framingham, Massachusetts, was arrested last weekend after allegedly beating his girlfriend. The Metro West Daily News says that Officer Eduardo Rivera, a 12-year police veteran, was arrested and charged with domestic assault and battery after the victim's statement was given to officers responding to the disturbance. Rivera is on paid leave until an investigation of the incident is complete. Three police officers in Milwaukee have been charged in connection with the beating of a man who was allegedly attacked by as many as 10 off-duty police officers outside of a party. Local media reports identify the three officers charged as John Bartlett, Daniel Masaryk, and Andrew Spengler. All were charged with substantial battery. Bartlett and Masaryk are charged with recklessly endangering safety, and Masaryk also faces a perjury charge. Witnesses to the beating say that 10 officers surrounded the man, kicking and beating him and accusing him of stealing a police badge. Witnesses also report that the attackers used racial slurs repeatedly during the beating. The investigation of the beating is not complete, and it is possible that other officers will be charged in the future. A report in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel has detailed past troubled histories of two of the officers charged. Bartlett has been accused of using excessive force three times in his 5 years in the department, all against black men, one of whom was beaten fatally. Masaryk used a stun gun on six people within an 11-week period last year. Police in James City, Virginia, arrested an 8-year-old at his school this week and charged him with disorderly conduct and assault and battery. The Associated Press reports that the child was accused of an outburst during which he headbutted a teacher and kicked an assistant principal after they didn't allow him to go outside and play with the other students. After leading the child from the school in handcuffs and taking him to a police station, the child was released into the custody of his parents. The police chief in Pahokee, Florida, resigned this week over a case where his officers are accused of beating a man. According to a report filed by Associated Press, the mayor and several town councilors witnessed three officers beating the man by chance. The man who was beaten by officers had a history of videotaping police and offering suspects advice on how to deal with their arrests. The Florida Department of Law Enforcement has been asked to investigate the incident because the mayor of the town has no confidence in the local department's ability to investigate themselves. On past programs, we have told you about three police officers in Memphis, Tennessee, who were facing charges of conspiracy in a plot that involved an alleged planned robbery, drugs, and prostitution. One of the officers charged, John Vaughn, pleaded guilty to his charges last month. This week, the Memphis Press reports that Officer Billy Scott has also changed his plea to guilty on charges relating to his part in the conspiracy. He will be sentenced in March 2006. Scott was accused of recruiting Vaughn to help with a drug deal and then paying him $4,000. He was also accused of conspiring with another officer, David Tate, and Tate's girlfriend, April Veach, in a plan to commit a theft and possibly murder the person whose home they planned to rob. Veach pleaded guilty to her charges on the same week as Vaughn. Tate, the alleged ringleader, is the only one of the accused still facing a trial. A police officer from Grays Lake, Illinois, who was already facing an assortment of criminal and departmental charges, is now facing new criminal charges. According to the Chicago Daily Herald, Officer David Williams was charged with unlawful communication with a witness and harassment after he sent an email to another police officer who was going to testify against him. In February, Williams was charged with stealing $14,000 from the Grays Lake Fraternal Order of Police Lodge, selling a department-owned automatic rifle, giving away a portable breath tester belonging to the department, and filing false documents in an attempt to hide the theft. Williams resigned from the force about 1 week before the first charges were laid against him. Seven police officers in Apache Junction, Arizona, have been forced off the town's police force in the last 9 months. The Arizona Republic reports that the officers have left the force after being targeted in an investigation which lasted 2 years. The investigation looked at 45 separate allegations against officers. Two reports from outside agencies which looked at the Apache Junction police force said they discovered a culture of sexual harassment and workplace abuse. Former police chief Robert Warner resigned in December 2003 after the first of the two reports. Since that time, two commanders, three sergeants, one patrolman, and one detective have left the force either through retirement or termination agreements. Commanders Dan Scott and Brian Duncan retired voluntarily after an inquest found evidence of sexual harassment, pornography, and other workplace misconduct. A former police officer in Miami was found guilty this week on charges of grand theft, conspiracy to commit grand theft, and three counts of official misconduct. A Miami Herald story says that Officer Wiebert Celestin planned with others to break up drug deals and keep the money for themselves. The others were undercover agents who were working to set up the officer. Celestin was caught on videotape pulling over a suspected drug dealer and taking $22,000 in cash. Two high-ranking officers in the Staunton, Massachusetts Police Department have been suspended this week after being charged with extortion, kidnapping, and assault and battery. The Enterprise reports that Chief Manuel Cachopa and Sergeant David Cohen were both placed on administrative leave a day after they were charged. The town's police department has been rocked by an investigation that continues to look at five of the force's other officers. A special prosecutor assigned to the probe has suggested that more charges against officers are likely to follow. Next up, a review of this week's Taser news.
I was strapped down on a bed, arms like this. He was on top of me. With the taser, he was on top of me. He said, before he jumped on me, he said, I guess I got to do this the old-fashioned way.
How is that any different than if he had his billy club or his pepper spray or even his gun and held it to the guy's head and said, if you don't give me what I want, I will shoot you?
It's a great tool for law enforcement.
50,000 volts going through your body at that point, there's nothing you can do. I don't believe it was used appropriately. I wasn't threatening to him, and if he was concerned about his safety, he should have called for backup. Before using the taser.
It can save injury to officers and suspects, and use of force with the taser can now be deployed several feet away, as before the taser, officers would have to go hands-on.
There's a lack right now of independent peer-reviewed research.
59% of the cases where they were used, only a misdemeanor was charged. And in only 9 out of the 90 cases, or 10%, were weapons involved. So I think the police department needs to seriously review their policies related to the use of the taser.
A police officer in Cincinnati, Ohio, accidentally shot another officer with a taser this week during a struggle with a man who was wanted on several traffic warrants. On Sunday night, a man in DeLand, Florida, died after being shot by police with a stun gun. Police said that the man had told him that he had taken cocaine. Studies, including an Amnesty International report on stun gun use released last November, suggest that certain drugs, including cocaine and some prescription medications, are frequently a factor in deaths linked to taser use. A 15-year-old girl was tasered at her high school in Roseville, Minnesota, last week after she returned to the school a day after being suspended and acted unruly. Police in Roseville schools have had access to the weapon for 1 month, but this was the first time one had been used. A lawsuit filed against stun gun manufacturer Taser International was dismissed this week. In June 2004, a Michigan man filed a suit against the company, claiming he was injured when he volunteered to be shocked at a taser demonstration. Two police officers in Sweetwater, Florida, were suspended this week following an incident where an off-duty officer working as a security guard repeatedly shocked a bar patron with a stun gun. Last week, a police officer in Orlando, Florida, shocked a man twice with a taser after he refused to give a urine sample at a hospital. Officer Peter Leinenkamp used his stun gun despite the fact that his victim was strapped to a hospital bed and posed no danger to the officer or to anyone else. This week, a forensic engineer speaking at a conference of the American Academy of Forensic Examiners issued a warning that stun guns can cause delayed cardiac arrest and that injuries to both officers and suspects may be slipping past authorities undetected. Law enforcement agencies across North America are reconsidering the deployment of stun guns. Police departments in California, Georgia, Ohio, Illinois, Indiana, Utah, Florida, and North Carolina have chosen not to deploy tasers or delayed deployment, citing concerns about the safety of the weapon. Some agencies have expressed concern that children as young as 6 and adults as old as 82 are being shocked by police officers with 50,000 volts of electricity for offenses as trivial as refusing to pay for a salad at a restaurant. Other police departments in Portland, Oregon, and Toronto this week announced plans to arm more officers with the devices. The company which makes the stun guns used by North American police departments, Arizona-based Taser International, is standing by their claim that their weapons are not responsible for any deaths and do not cause heart attacks. Of the 18,000 police departments in the United States, 7,000 have tasers in use. Taser International claims that, so far, over 100,000 officers have been shocked by stun guns voluntarily during demonstrations of their products. Other than the killings already mentioned in this program, police also killed people this week in Houston, Texas, San Antonio, Texas, San Francisco, California, Oshawa, Ontario, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Delray Beach, Florida, and Portsmouth, Virginia. On Saturday, Toronto police arrested community activist and CKLN programmer Wendy Maxwell at an International Women's Day rally on the campus of Ryerson University. She was arrested on an immigration warrant, which was acted upon at the discretion of the Toronto Police Service. Although she filed an appeal of a deportation order over a year ago, this application does not prevent her from being deported from the country before her case is heard by immigration officials. There is a good chance that her appeal to remain in the country on humanitarian and compassionate grounds should be successful for several reasons. Wendy Maxwell will be deported to Costa Rica, where as a black lesbian she faces almost certain persecution. Also, she has been in Canada for over 7 years, and in that time has been extremely busy helping others through her community activism. She has worked with Street Life Support Services, the Black Coalition for AIDS Prevention, the Latin American Coalition to End Violence Against Women, and other organizations during her time in Toronto. Earlier this week, she was denied bail because a judge considered her a flight risk. She is currently being held at a jail in Milton, Ontario. Yesterday, we learned that Wendy Maxwell's deportation to Costa Rica is scheduled for Monday, March 14th. Next, we'll listen to excerpts from an interview with Wendy Maxwell from Monday when she spoke with CKLN's Kristen Schwartz.
Well, what basically happened is that I was finishing setting up the CKLN's cookie and T-shirt table at the fair. And two police officers who obviously already knew who I was walked up to me and looked at me and pointed to me and asked me to come over. And I said, come over, you come over. And they're like, no, come over, we're going to ask you some questions. I walked down to them, already knew what it was all about. I walked down to them and I'm like, yes. And they started asking me, you know, my name and whatever. I said, well, I don't really need to answer any of these questions, you know, it's my right, right? And my reluctance to do that just caused them. They said, well, you're under arrest. And I'm like, well, what for? And they wouldn't say what I was under arrest for. And they cuffed me. And then I'm like, is everybody seeing this? I'm getting cuffed and nobody's telling me what am I arrested for. And it wasn't until after people started looking and there was this camera rolling and whatnot that they decided to say, well, okay, you have a Canada-wide warrant for your arrest. I'm like, okay. So they take me to the car, but I'm still like, I'm here screaming. I'm totally freaking. I'm like, please don't let them take me. Please don't let them take me. Like, I know what's going to happen now. Please don't let them take me. I'm going to die. And people out there were like, don't worry, we're going to call your lawyer. And there were some people, familiar faces, friends of mine who, like, they knew who to call already and whatnot. The march was coming in. The International Women's Day march was coming in from OISE. And as they saw the women coming in, the police officers saw it prudent to turn around the corner. So they turned around the corner from the Girard Street entrance of Ryerson. So they were still within Ryerson campus, but they were around the corner in the street. So they were parked there for a good over half an hour. Parked there, calling me in, basically trying to verify the whole situation, telling them, well, we have someone in custody that was reported, da, 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 da. We want to bring her in, and brought me back in over there at the station. At the station, though, well, I was cuffed, right? At the station, they took my jacket. Because according to them, because it had strings and I could hang myself with the little beanie strings in it, and they took my shoes. They took out the strings of my shoes and took my shoes because they said that I could throw those shoes on somebody's face. So here I was with a sleeveless top and walking on my socks in this cold floor. Put in a cell, waited until this immigration officer came in, and he says to me, well, because you're a bit rowdy and you resisted arrest, that's what they said, that I resisted arrest, you are going to be sent to the Vernier facility for women instead of the Comfort Inn. And I'm like, I never resisted arrest. I don't know what they're talking about. And he's like, well, the officer said that, and I am going to go. I'm inclined to go with what the officers are saying. And I'm like, you can go with whatever you want. I did not resist arrest. Never mind. On my way out, they're putting shackles on me, and I'm like, I'm freaking here. I'm like screaming at them. I'm like, excuse me, why are you putting, you please don't put those on. First I said, please do not put those on. And the guy is like, well, ma'am, I just need to do my job. I'm like, your job? 500 years my people have gone through this shit, and you still want to put us through that? No, you're not going to put the shackles on. And he's still telling me that he's going to put the shackles on. I'm like, what are you so afraid of? Am I going to run away from here? There's 10 police officers. There's a freaking detective in front of here. Where am I going to run to? Why do you need to put shackles on? Like, why is there a necessity? Oh, well, regulations and da, da, da. Like, regulations? I screamed at all of them. I'm like, you guys are afraid of the big, black, bad, black woman. You are afraid of the big, bad black woman that is come here to break down the freaking system. That's what you're afraid of. You know, all of them, about 8 different, you know, police supervisors and chiefs and whatever bullshit they were. But whoever they were, their heads down, not one looked up to me to say nothing. Not one could lift up their eyes and look at me in the eye. Because they know it was bullshit what they were going on with anyways. So, yeah, as I was saying, well, that was the treatment back there. I mean, and all that process is one person during the transportation from the 51 precinct to a Vernier facility. There was one person that, you know, I felt was very, very supportive of me, in a sense. Like, I don't really want to put her in evidence or anything, but there's a sister that came through, a police officer or whatever, that was very supportive, was supportive enough to, like, give me an eye of, like, make me feel that I wasn't alone at that moment, you know, and gave me strength. And I would like for her to know that I appreciate that, but at the same time, I don't want to put her in any jeopardy for her job or whatever, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, and then here, well, what can I say? I mean, I slept in a secluded, segregated area for a bit, and then they passed me over here, and here is, like, max security. I haven't seen the sun since I've been here. I haven't been outside this walls since I've been here. They tell you what to do, when to get up, when to eat, when to do anything, when to do your laundry, when to shower. You know, I just feel that a lot of these women could help, you know, could use a lot of help as well. But I also feel blessed of the fact that the help is there for me too. I feel incredibly blessed, but I think I've been put here for a purpose, you know. And I vow to this. I definitely vow to this, that if a Canadian system, a Canadian government allows me to stay in Canada, I'm going to do outreach work for the women's jails, man. Because there's got to be something done. These women are in total isolation.
Mm-hmm. Do they get a lot of visits? Can you tell? Can you tell if women are getting visits? Like, do they make a lot of calls? Like, what's the...
You can make calls. You can make calls. You can receiving calls is a hard thing. You can receive calls from your lawyers, though. But you can make calls, collect calls only. If you're going to receive a visit, it's like 2 days in advance. That 24, I think it's 24 or 48 hours in advance. That that the request, the person that wants to visit needs to make a request. I mean, and when you come and see the visitor, and when you go to your visitor, it's like it's a glass, it's across a glass only.
Mhm.
Mhm. I don't understand what's in these for having women in these conditions.
Yeah.
I don't understand what so much threat that they pose. Get searched 5 times a day and shit like that. Whenever they have to go from one place to another. I wrote a little piece today, and I was hoping to read it on the air, if you didn't mind. Can I do that?
Please, please.
Okay. My dear friends, I fell in this pit, dug for me by envy. Didn't see it. It was covered by hypocrisy of hate. Hate with a familiar face. This is no joke. I'm in jail. Not guilty of a crime, but as a woman with no status, I'm treated as a criminal. What is a criminal, anyhow? I'm in a maximum security range. Met an inmate who stole food. 2 others that stood up to their husband's abuse. Some rob or sell drugs to survive. Please tell me, who is the criminal? Is it us in here? Or a system that put us in here? Who is the criminal? All I want is to be free. All I want is to be safe. I want the chance to raise my children in safety, the chance to build a better society for them. That is not much to ask, or is it? I'm in a maximum security range because I was not quiet or meek. I cried out to the troops coming in from the march, please don't let them take me back. Please don't let them send me back. I knew you would have my back, and so you did. In all my sisters, brothers, and allies out there, I find my strength. I'm standing strong on my book, on your backs. And on the backs of all those who came before me, because of you, change shall come. Because of you, I still have hope. I know for a fact that my time to die has not yet arrived. Tiko basi igile hin ogbamanwo. If defense is not propped, it will fall and collapse. Yoruba proverb. I just cooked up that in like 2 minutes now. In like the past hour. But yeah, what I can say for the most is like women's necessities, basic necessities are really denied. Like black women need, for example, products for their skin, products for their hair, and in reality per capita there's more black women in here than there are any other race, right? And those rights are denied. Your friends and family cannot bring anything from outside. Cannot bring nothing from the outside for you. If anything, they can bring money for you, and you can invest that money in a canteen, what they call a canteen, which is like a supply store or something that you submit a request to. So if you don't have the money in by a certain date, when the canteen comes through, you cannot get any stuff out, you know. Anybody wants to come visit you, it takes 2 days for the request to be processed. I don't know, it's like, it's crazy. That's all I gotta say, it's crazy. I mean, if it's not because of the constant support of my friends and the fact that I know that everybody out there is like really supportive of me and sending me positive vibes from the outside, I'll be going crazy in here. I'll be pulling my hair.
I would like to strongly urge everyone, particularly the Canadian listeners of this program, to support Wendy Maxwell by taking one or more of the following actions. Federal Immigration Minister Joe Volpe has the right to grant Wendy Maxwell a temporary residence permit so that she can remain in Canada until her appeal can be heard. Please tell the minister to do so. He can be reached by phone at 416-781-5583 and 613-992-6361. Volpe can be faxed at 416-781-5586 and 613-992-9791. You can email him at minister@cic.gc.ca. The immigration enforcement officer who has the responsibility for Wendy Maxwell's case has the discretion to defer the impending deportation. Please ask him to do so. His name is Martin Kosicek, and he can be reached by phone at 905-405-3630 and by fax at 905-405-3529. Please act quickly to help stop this deportation. For more information, you can visit ocap.ca/Wendy for updates. That's all for this week. Tune into this station for more next week. Email your comments and story ideas to ron@ckln.fm. Thanks to everyone who sent articles for this week's show. From CKLN 88.1 FM in Toronto, I'm Ron Anisich. Each week we end Bad Cop No Donut with a song. This week it's Police Story by Anti-Flag.
Welcome back. That was Bad Cop, No Donut. You're listening to Kootenai Club Radio 93.5 FM CGLY, broadcasting live from beautiful Nelson, British Columbia, and over the worldwide mycelium on www.kootenaiclubradio.com. If you want downloads of previous shows, you can go to www.radio4all.net, and it's all there. That's the Activist Infos Radio Collective, and Fame of the Cosmos is in there these days. If you're listening down the lake, you're listening at 96.5 FM. This is an article from the Tai News and Views for Feisty Folk. Strange but true, the American Secret Service in Vancouver is listed in the phone book, but the Drug Enforcement Administration is not. This seems to be a measure of just how secretive the DEA is. They opened shop quietly in Vancouver last year, but the public has little idea of what they are doing, let alone what that they are here. And the DEA would like to keep it that way. How did you get my phone number? Is the first thing the Vancouver DEA agent Kenneth Peterson asks in a booming voice. If it's classified, he'd best notify his counterparts at the DEA office in Seattle, as they gave it to me. He sidesteps nearly all my questions, praising the beauty of the city instead. The only information he would divulge is that the DEA has three people here, and that others are in and out, and they came to town in June 2003. Vancouver does have some drug problems. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here, he says. How many operations have they been involved in? He would not say. He would not give his opinion on Vancouver's drug policy or its safe injection site. I only stick to facts, he says. It's like asking someone from the marijuana party to give their opinion on the DEA. It's very slanted. He pauses. Not to say that we're slanted. Even Vancouverites who are close watchers of the war on drugs are shocked to hear that the DEA is on the scene. Former Mayor Philip Owen, one of the province's most prominent drug policy activists, had no idea until informed by the Tai. I want to go knock on their door and say, "What are you doing here?" he exclaims. Other sources can help fill in the picture. In 2001, the U.S. Embassy spokesman in Ottawa, Bud Schenkman, said Vancouver needed an office because of its booming marijuana industry. In April 2002, then-DEA head Asaj Hutchinson spoke in front of the House Committee on International Relations, trying to reconfigure the war on drugs as a war on terror in the wake of 9/11, and used the term narco-terrorism to characterize the money flow. At the same time, he asked for an additional $35.6 million to fight heroin trafficking, to be partly directed to the Southeastern Asian trade. He wanted new DEA offices in Kunming, China, and in Vancouver. As most Southeast Asian heroin goes to the U.S., enters, he said, via Chinese freighter to Vancouver. Both the U.S. and Canadian government said yes. That brought the DEA to a total of 80 foreign field offices, including one already in Ottawa, in 58 countries. On the agency's website, the Canadian offices are lumped in with the Europe, Middle East, Africa section. Oddly, in the list of field office phone numbers, only Peshawar, Tashkent, Kabul, and Vancouver are left blank. We shouldn't worry about the DEA, says Vancouver Mayor Larry Campbell, a former RCMP officer. Even before they had an office here, we did joint operations with them. Since 1990, a mutual legal assistance treaty between Canada and the U.S. has allowed officers of each country to share databases and other information to fight cross-border crime. However, critics argue now that the DEA has a permanent base in Vancouver, they will influence the types of investigations undertaken with offers of money and agents to support their pet projects. For instance, the DEA website names marijuana eradication a major program area. On the other hand, BC has by far the lowest rate in Canada of criminal charges compared to the police noted incidents of marijuana possession at 17.2%, a 2001 study showed. Of course, there is no support for gang-related drug activity, but the Americans often see terrorism behind every puff of smoke. In November 2003, DEA agent Kenneth Peterson was quoted in the Vancouver Sun as saying about the idea of a terrorist link to the Maple Ridge base pot operation, "I'm sure it's a possibility." The newspaper pointed out that the officer in charge of the whole cross-border investigation said that it had no connection with terrorism. In any case, the officers seized 3,000 marijuana plants and $262,000 of cash in British Columbia and made 14 arrests here and in California. On the other front, the DEA website names the Vancouver office as a participant in Operation Brain Drain, which ended last month. It stamped out a major methamphetamine operation with 90 arrests, as well as seizing nearly 100 pounds of meth and $3.5 million in Canadian funds. Canadians supplied the raw ingredient, ephedrine, and it was cooked in labs in California and Mexico to be sold throughout the states. All we know of what the DEA is doing is coming from their own press releases, and that is not enough, says Michael Vaughn, the policy director of the BC Civil Liberties Association in Vancouver. The war on drugs mentality is a complete failure, and now they are trying to import it here, she says. We are concerned about any informal agreements of sharing information between officers of different nations and about the techniques they may use to get the information. How do we know they are not infringing on the rights as individuals and as a nation? It does an end run around our right to privacy. In fact, one serious DEA infraction was noted in the province in August 2002. The agency had not yet opened their Vancouver office, but were doing a joint operation in the lower mainland with the RCMP. DEA informant CS2, an American posed as a Colombian trafficker, and lured a man into a cocaine deal in White Rock. The DEA asked the RCMP for permission to continue, which involved a California meeting and then the sale of 1 kilo bags of cocaine in Vancouver, but the RCMP said no. For some reason, the DEA continued the deal anyway and sent their informant across the border again, which kiboshed the request to extradite the entrapped man for a U.S. trial. BC Supreme Court Judge Janice Dillon ruled the DEA conduct illegal, shocking, and detrimental to international cooperative agreements to assist in criminal matters. The BC Civil Liberties Association's Vaughan is particularly concerned about how this spring the FBI and DEA asked Canada to change our laws to compel companies to make it technically easy to tap internet exchanges and cell phone calls. Critics say this sounds rather like a spying carte blanche. We think that stinks, Vaughan says. It's all below the radar and unchallengeable. That's an older article that I found, but definitely locks in that there is a DEA office in Vancouver and it's operating. We know the DEA is operating in our area now, and the U.S. Homeland Security Agency. So, yes, our sovereignty is on the line, and the more we allow this to happen, the less sovereignty we will have. It's an awful thing. It's an awful, awful thing. So I'm going to play a bit of Terrence McKenna tonight, just because We haven't played him for a long time. This is actually Sheldrake, Abraham, and McKenna. And this is probably one of the best talks I think I've ever heard by these three. That is for sure. So here we go, a little Terrence McKenna before the night ends, before we say goodbye.
Of the trialogues today is the notion is that we will deal with some aspect of the evolutionary mind, that being the title and theme of our new book. So in my mind, what this section is to deal with is the evolutionary mind and machines. This is something which was barely mentioned or even implied in the first section. And the format and so forth will be as in the last session. So just to lay out some concepts relative to how machines fit into this. It's very interesting that Samuel Butler Taylor is an intellectual who has not really been given his full due, because in the 19th century he was understood to be a critic of Darwinism, and Darwinism was all the fashion. In a sense, I think Taylor was misunderstood. He was not so much a critic of Darwin as someone who wanted to extend Darwinian mechanics and Darwinian theory into domains that perhaps did not seem intuitive to a biologist. My little story about the evolution of songs that I cribbed from Danny Hillis in the last session is an example of Darwinian processes operating, indeed, in a non-material realm, operating among syntactical structures. And it is now proper to speak of molecular evolution, the competing of various enzyme systems in abiotic or prebiotic chemical regimes, where selection, adaptability, extinction, and expansion of populations all occur very much as in the domain of biology. Well, you know, it was Nietzsche who said, I believe, in speaking of nihilism, that this strangest of all guests is now at the door. Well, I go to even weirder dinner parties than Friedrich Nietzsche. Nihilism hardly shakes us up at all. There are yet weirder guests seeking admission to the dinner party of the evolving discourse of where we are in space and time. And one of these weirdest of all guests is the AI, the artificial intelligence, the Wintermute of familiar science fiction. And so, as this is an attempt to look at evolution in many domains and its implications for us, I wanted this morning to touch on this subject of the evolution of consciousness as it relates to machines. Now, it may not come as a revelation to Ralph, who has spent his life in mathematics, but it has certainly come to me recently as a revelation, and I want to give George Dyson some credit here. His book, Darwin Among the Machines, is a wonderful introduction to some of the ideas I want to touch on this morning, one of which seemed to me to go quite deep, is the realization that when human beings think clearly, the way they think can be mathematically defined. This is what is called symbolic logic or Boolean algebra. Words like and, or, if, and then can be given extremely precise, formal, mathematical definitions. And because of this fact, that clear thinking can be mathematically formalized, there is a potential bridge between ourselves and calculating machinery. Because indeed, calculating machinery is driven by rules of formal logic. That's what programming is. Code that does not embody the rules of formal mathematical logic is bad code, unrunnable code. So, as I say, this may seem a subtle point, but to me it had the force of revelation, because it means good thinking is not just simply aesthetically pleasing or concurrent with the model that generates it. Good thinking, whether you've ever studied mathematics for a moment or not, can be formally defined. So now, with that idea in mind, let's look at the discourse about collectivism that has informed the Western dialogue on this subject. And by collectivism, I mean social collectivism. The first great name that you encounter in the modern era, broadly speaking, when we talk about collectivism, and Rupert mentioned by chance this morning this name, is that of Thomas Hobbes. The great theoretician of social paranoia is always how I've thought of Hobbes, until I began to look at this machine intelligence question. And Hobbes, in his Leviathan, makes it very clear that society is a complex system of mechanical feedback loops and relationships that, though Hobbes did not have the vocabulary to state this, relationships that can be defined by code. This leads me to the second insight necessary to follow this line of thought, and that is that the new dispensation in the sciences, I think, is can be placed in all its manifestations under the umbrella of the idea that what is important about nature is that it is information. And the real tension is not between matter and spirit or time and space. The real tension is between information and nonsense. If you will. Nonsense does not serve the purposes of organizational appetites, whether those organizational appetites are being expressed in a chemical system, a molecular system, a social system, a climaxed rainforest, or whatever. Now, we have known since 1950 at some level, through the sequencing or the defining of the structure of DNA, that we are but information, ultimately. Every single one of us, in our unique expression, could be expressed as a very long string of codons. Codons are the four-valent system by which DNA specifies the need for certain amino acids. And in a sense, what you are is the result of a certain kind of program being run on a certain kind of hardware. The hardware of the ribosomes, the submolecular structures that move RNA through themselves and out of an ambient chemical medium select building blocks, which are then put together to create a three-dimensional object which has the quality of life. But the interesting thing about this is that life, therefore, can be digitally defined. And I'm very influenced at the moment by the Australian science fiction writer Greg Egan, who has brought me to the understanding that code is code, whether it's being run by ribosomes, whether it's being run on some kind of traditional hardware platform, or whether it's being exchanged pheromonally among termites, or through the messages of advertising and political propaganda in social systems. Code is code. Well, until 5 or 6 years ago, it was very fashionable to completely dismiss the possibility of autonomous synthetic intelligence. Some of you may know the work of Hubert Dreyfus, who 14 or 15 years ago wrote a book called What Computers Can't Do. But these early critiques of AI, like early AI theory, were naive, and the kinds of life which they and the kinds of intelligence which the critics mitigated against are no longer even proposed or on the table. And those who say artificial intelligence or the self-organizing awareness of machines is an impossibility, those voices have gone strangely silent. Because the prosecution of the materialist assumption, which rules scientific theory making largely at the moment, leads to the awareness that we are, by these definitions, machines. We are machines of a special type and with special advanced abilities. But as we now, through our own process of technical evolution, contemplate such frontiers as nanotechnology, where we propose to completely restructure the design process so that instead of fabricating objects, massive objects at industrial temperatures, the temperatures that melt titanium and melt steel and produce massive toxic output, now a new vision looms, building as nature builds, building atom by atom at the temperatures of organic nature, which on this planet never exceed 115 degrees Fahrenheit. All life on this planet is created at that temperature and below. As our understanding of the machinery, the genetic machinery that supports organic being deepens, and as our ability to manipulate at the atomic and molecular level also proceeds apace, we are on the brink of the possible emergence of some kind of alien intelligence of a sort we did not anticipate. Not friendly traders from Zenebel Ganubi stopping in to set us straight, but the actual genesis out of our own circumstance of a kind of super intelligence. And in the same way that the daughter of Zeus sprang full-blown from his forehead, the AI may be upon us without warning. The first problem is we don't know what ultra-intelligence would look like. We don't know whether it would even have any interest in our dear selves and our concerns. Vast amounts of the world that we call human is already under the control of artificial intelligences, including very vital parts of our political and social dynamo. For example, how much tin, bauxite and petroleum is extracted, at what rate it enters the various distribution systems, at what rate tankers are filled in Abu Dhabi, at what rate oil refineries are run in Richmond. The world price of gold and platinum every day is set, in fact, by machines. Inventory control has grown far too complex for any human being to understand or wish to understand. And in fact, and this is a critical juncture, we have reached the place where we no longer design our machines in quite the way we once did. Now we define their operational parameters for a machine, which then attacks the problem and solves it by methods and insights available to it, but not available to us. So the architecture of the latest chips are actually, at the microphysical level, the decisions as to how that chip should be organized is a decision made entirely by machines. Human engineers set the performance specs, but they don't care how this output is reached. Every day up in Silicon Valley, there are people who go happily to work laboring on what they call the great work. And the great work, as defined by these people, is the handing over of the drama of intelligent evolution to entities sufficiently intelligent to appreciate that drama. And they all are what we might mistake for home appliances if we weren't paying attention. In the first session this morning, there was quite a bit of talk and assumption among the three of us that complex systems generate unexpected connections and forms of order. The internet is the most complex distributed high-speed system ever put in place on this planet. And notice that while we've been waiting for the Palladians to descend or for the face on Mars to be confirmed, all the machines around us, the cybernetic devices around us in the past 10 years have quietly crossed the threshold into telepathy. The word processor sitting on your desk 10 years ago was approximately as intelligent as a paperweight, or, to make an analogy in a different direction, approximately as intelligent as a single animal or plant cell. But when you connect the wires together, the machines become telepathic. They exchange information with each other according to their needs. And
all right, that's the end of the show. I've been your host, Dustin Sunflower. I hope you've enjoyed the show. This has been Fane of the Cosmos. I love you guys.